serious about wanting to sell you some information. Still, we're going to assume that someone is watching."
Irene folded her arms. "Sorry about the accommodations back there."
"It's a little cramped, but not nearly as bad as the compartment I used for the Corridor of Infinity effect."
"Was that the trick that nearly got you killed?"
For a moment, she thought he wasn't going to answer.
"No," he said finally. "That was the Cage of Death."
She wanted to ask what exactly had gone wrong, but her intuition told her that the question was far too intrusive. The kind of question that only a very close friend or a lover could ask. He had kissed her, but that did not make them close friends or lovers.
"I ran into one of Nick Tremaine's biggest fans today," she said. "He tried to warn me off the story. He said I shouldn't make trouble for Tremaine."
"Think he was from the studio?"
"No, he wasn't a tough guy, just a fanatical fan. The waitress at Mel's Cafe says he's been a regular for about a week. She thinks he's harmless."
"Tremaine checked in a week ago."
"I know.
I'll have O'Connor, the head of hotel security, see what he can find out about the guy."
"All right. But I'm pretty sure he's just another obsessed fan."
The phone rang. She flinched. Even though she had been waiting for the summons, the sound nevertheless startled her.
"Here we go," she whispered.
She jumped out of the car and grabbed the receiver.
"This is Irene Glasson," she said. "There's an old abandoned warehouse at the end of Miramar Road," Daisy said.
Her voice was infused with the same whispery quality, but this time she spoke very slowly and with great precision.
"Bootleggers used it during Prohibition, but it's been empty ever since repeal. I'll wait for you there. Remember, come alone. Deal's off if I see anyone else."
There was a short pause.
"And don't forget the $20.
"Wait a minute, how am I supposed to find this place? I'm new in town, remember? I'm assuming you don't want me to ask directions at the nearest bar or gas station."
"No."
Panic edged the word.
"Don't let anyone know where you're going. I'll give you directions."
Daisy rattled off a string of instructions and hung up the phone. Irene got back into her car and fired up the engine.
"We're heading for an abandoned warehouse at the end of Miramar Road. Know it?"
"It's located several miles outside of town on a bad road. It will take us a good 45 minutes to get there from here. According to the locals, the warehouse used to be a bootlegger distribution point."
Daisy mentioned that.
"Did she happen to mention that there's a dock and a boathouse attached?"
That stopped her for a few seconds.
"A dock and a boathouse?"
"That old warehouse sits on the edge of a small hidden cove. That's why the bootleggers used it. They could bring in boatloads of illegal liquor without drawing the attention of the authorities." Oliver paused for emphasis. "They also used it to get rid of bodies."
"Bodies?"
"The business was very competitive."
"I see."
"All in all, sounds like the ideal location for another drowning accident," Oliver said.
She caught her breath. "Yes, it does. All right, you've made your point. Do you really think Daisy intends to try to murder me?"
"I think it's more likely that our killer is using Daisy to lure you to the scene. I warned you this was probably a setup."
She drummed the fingers of her left hand on the wheel.
"But what if Daisy is telling the truth?"
"In that case, you're right. We may come away from the meeting with some hard information that we can use to figure out who murdered Gloria Maitland."
There was a new note in his voice, she thought, one that she had not heard before. She struggled to come up with a description and, finally, settled on anticipation. He sounded like a man who was looking forward to a little excitement.
"What if you're right after all?" she said. "What if this meeting with Daisy is a setup?"
"We pull a rabbit out of the hat."
Chapter 24.
Daisy Jennings struck another match to light another cigarette, the last one in the pack. She had been chain-smoking ever since she made the first phone call to the reporter earlier in the day. Her throat was raw and her nerves were frayed. Her pulse was beating much too fast. The match shook a little in her fingers. It was the damned warehouse that was making her jumpy. No wonder the local kids claimed that it was haunted by the ghosts of the gangsters' victims. She had brought a kerosene lantern with her, but it was burning low. She should have taken the time to refill it before driving out to the warehouse, she thought. Too late now. She could only hope that the reporter would be on time. She got the cigarette lit and hastily blew out the match. She dropped it into the empty tin can she had found in a corner. She was being very careful with the matches and the butts. The warehouse was a fire trap. The wide door that opened onto the loading dock at the back of the structure hung on its hinges. She could hear the water lapping and the creak of rotting wood. It sounded like some creepy monster of the deep, feasting on the bodies that had been dumped into the cove. Maybe she had seen a few too many horror movies. Occasionally, she heard ominous rustlings in the shadows. Each time she hoisted the lantern to take a closer look, she caught sight of a furry body with a hairless, snake-like tail. The bootleggers had pulled up stakes and moved on to other business ventures, but the rats had set up shop amid the heaps of moldy straw, wooden crates, and leftover packing materials that littered the place. She tossed the empty pack aside and inhaled deeply. The action triggered another coughing fit. So much for the brand's promise that its product had a soothing effect on the throat. It just went to show that you couldn't trust the claims made in the magazine ads. Couldn't trust the movie stars or the doctors who made those claims for the cigarette companies either. But then a smart woman didn't trust anyone, she thought, least of all a charming, good-looking movie star. Nick Tremaine was a dream man, and he had promised to fulfill her dreams. He had said he would get her a screen test at his studio. She knew now that he had lied, just like all the others before him. But at least Tremaine had come through with some cash, a lot of it. None of the others had been so generous. The first half was paid up front. After tonight, she would collect the second half. That would give her enough money to buy the clothes she would need to start over in L.A. No more Hollywood dreams. Her looks would start to fade soon. It was time to find a rich older man, preferably one who was going senile. A guy who could give her the financial security she would need to get through the years ahead. The extra $20 from Irene Glasson hardly mattered, Daisy thought. She had been told to make the demand for money so the scene looked authentic. A reporter expected to pay for a tip. She stopped pacing and sat down on an empty crate to finish the cigarette. Somewhere in the darkness, the thick floorboards groaned again. She shuddered and glanced over her shoulder. There was nothing to see except darkness and shadows. She checked her watch. She had arrived early, as instructed, after making the 11:30 call from the last gas station phone booth on Miramar Road. The reporter would have had to drive back through town, find Miramar Road, and then negotiate the dirt lane down the hillside to the warehouse. She wouldn't be here for another half hour or so, maybe longer if she got lost. Please don't get lost, Irene Glasson. I need to get away from this place. She finished the cigarette and started to grind out the butt in the makeshift ashtray. But her fingers were trembling so badly that she accidentally knocked the tin can onto its side. Dead matches and butts spilled out. Thankfully, they didn't fall onto a pile of straw, but the very idea of all the used smoking materials in such close proximity to the flammable items that cluttered the warehouse made her shudder. Hastily, she bent down to scoop the discarded matches and butts back into the tin can. The safest thing to do was dump them into the water. She went out the freight door and walked a short distance along the dock. There was enough light from the lantern and the moon to allow her to see what she was doing. She tipped the can upside down and dumped the contents into the black water. Only about another half an hour to wait. Another half hour and she would have earned the rest of the money she needed to start a new life in L.A. What a joke, she thought. This was her first and only real acting job, unless you counted all the sex scenes she had starred in over the years. She had given some very fine performances in the gardens of the Paradise Club and in various hotel room beds. The vacationing stars and directors and studio executives had all made promises, and they had all lied. At least she was going to get paid for this night's work. All she had to do was stick to the script. She heard the creak of wood behind her, a footstep. It was the only warning she got. Panic flashed, threatening to choke her. She started to turn, but it was too late. The blow to her head stunned her. She was dimly aware of tumbling off the dock into the water. She fell endlessly into darkness, and then there was nothing. Chapter 25. There's a clearing around the front of the warehouse, Irene announced from the driver's seat. One car. It must be Daisy's. Oliver stayed where he was, crouched behind the front seat, and tried to visualize the scene in his head. Any sign of Jennings?
My headlights are shining directly on her car. Doesn't look like she's in it. There's some light coming from inside the warehouse, though. A lantern.
I'm going to take a look. Stay here. Keep the car running, headlights on, until I get out. The glare will blind anyone who might be watching from inside the warehouse.
What exactly are you going to do? Irene asked.
She was worried, he thought. He rather liked the idea that she might be concerned for his safety. But it was far more likely that she was afraid he would ruin her chance at the big story.
I just want to check out the area, he said.
Are you sure that's a good idea?
It struck me as a better idea than walking straight into an ambush. If everything looks legit, I'll wave you in. Got that?
Yes.
She did not sound happy about the plan, but she had agreed to it. That was good enough, he decided. He cracked the door open, grabbed the cane, and worked his way out of the back seat and into the shadows at the side of the narrow road. The maneuver sent a couple of shock waves through his leg. His forehead was suddenly damp with sweat. He breathed into the pain. It receded somewhat. He really was out of shape, he reflected. There had been a time when he could maneuver his way out of a locked trunk or a steel cage. Underwater, bound hand and foot. But in spite of the damned leg, he was strangely energized. It had been 2 long years since he'd experienced the old thrill, and this time it was the real deal. No magic involved. He had Irene to thank for the drug-like rush of excitement that was coursing through him. He would pay a price later. The leg was going to bother him more than usual for a couple of days, but it would be worth it. He had a bottle full of aspirin and some excellent whiskey waiting for him at Casa del Mar. Irene had lowered the window on the driver's side of the car. He spoke to her from the shadows.
"Are you all right?" she asked him uneasily.
Irritation crackled through him.
"I'm fine," he said. "Give me a few minutes to go around behind the warehouse and make sure there isn't anyone except Jennings inside. Douse the lights and the car engine as soon as I give the signal. We don't want to attract any attention if we can avoid it."
There was no traffic on Miramar Road.
"You never know. If a couple of kids out for a late-night cruise happen to see the lights, they might get curious."
"All right," she said.
"Remember, stay in the car until I wave you in. If anything looks like it's not going well, get the hell out of here, understand?"
"Yes, yes, I've got it. What about you?"
"Appearances to the contrary, I can take care of myself."
He did not wait for her to acknowledge the order. He was accustomed to people doing what he told them to do. He'd had a lot of experience in the role of boss. First on stage, where even small mistakes in a carefully staged illusion could destroy a career or get someone badly injured, even killed. Now, as the owner of a hotel that catered to a fickle and often bizarre clientele, he'd managed to keep a lot of people employed during the worst of the hard times. The country was finally emerging from the aftermath of the crash, but his staff was loyal. No one had left to seek other opportunities. So yes, he'd become accustomed to people doing what they were told. He reached inside his jacket and took the gun out of the holster. Cane in one hand, weapon in the other, he continued toward the warehouse, hugging the deep night just beyond the headlight beams. He knew from his experience establishing lines of sight on a brightly lit stage that the audience never noticed the assistants dressed in black who worked in the shadows. When he got close to Daisy's car, he saw that Irene was right. There was no one sitting in the vehicle. He took a chance and moved to stand next to the driver's door. Nobody was hiding in the rear seat. He eased his way around to the rear of the warehouse. The full moon, combined with the lantern light spilling out through the open freight door, allowed him to see the old dock and the squat shape of the boathouse. He flattened his back against the wall at one side of the freight door. "Daisy Jennings?" he said. There was no response. He raised his voice a little, but kept his tone cool and unthreatening. "I'm Oliver Ward. We've met. I insisted on accompanying Miss Glasson tonight. I didn't want her to take the risk of coming alone. I'm sure you can understand. Sorry for the change of plan, but I brought $100 with me. I hope that will serve as an apology." Nothing. Gun extended, he leaned forward slightly and took a quick look around the interior of the warehouse. The lantern provided enough light to reveal that there was no sign of anyone inside. It also revealed the handbag sitting on a wooden crate. Not good, he decided. Daisy Jennings should have been greeting him and his $100 apology with open arms. Time to leave. He grabbed his cane and started back around the warehouse. His only goal now was to get Irene as far away as possible. The moonlight glinted on a small object on the dock. He had not noticed it earlier. He told himself it wasn't important, but he paused anyway, hooked the handle of the cane over his arm, and took out the flashlight. He switched it on and pinned the object in the beam. A woman's shoe lay on its side. He went a little closer and aimed the light at the water. The body bobbed just under the surface. Daisy Jennings. A setup. Just as he had feared from the start. But the victim was Jennings. Evidently, she really had known something that could have hurt Tremaine. He turned off the flashlight and dropped it into the pocket of his jacket. Cane in one hand, gun in the other, he made his way as swiftly as possible around the side of the warehouse. The growl of heavy motorcycle engines approaching at speed on Miramar Road reverberated through the night. There was no good reason for motorcycles to be prowling the empty stretch of road at that hour. It looked like the cleanup crew was about to arrive. Chapter 26. Irene heard the thunder of motorcycle engines on Miramar Road and knew that Oliver had been right. It was a setup. She did the first thing she could think of. She killed the headlights. She kept the Ford's engine running, ready for a fast getaway, and watched the shadows around the front of the warehouse, willing Oliver to appear. He did. She could see him silhouetted against the lantern light, but he wasn't coming toward her. He was signaling her to get out of the vehicle. Light sparked in her car mirrors. The motorcycles had reached the entrance of the dirt road that led down to the warehouse. She realized that her Ford was directly in their path. She turned off the engine, grabbed her handbag, jumped out of the front seat, and ran toward Oliver. She stumbled a little on the uneven road. "Careful!" he shouted. By the time she reached him, he had the front door of the warehouse open.
She rushed inside. Oliver followed. "Turn down the lantern," he said. She heard him slam the old rusty bolt home, locking the door. Unfortunately, that left the two windows. Both had been shattered long ago, leaving only a few shards of glass in the frames. She hurried to the lantern and put it out. At least they would no longer be silhouetted in its glare. She whirled around to see what was happening. The headlights of two motorcycles were halfway down the warehouse road. They were forced to halt behind her Ford. The engines roared, the riders enraged by the obstacle. "Your car is blocking their path," Oliver said. He spoke from somewhere near one of the empty windows. "They'll have to get off their motorcycles if they want to come any closer. That will even the odds a little. Get down. Stay away from the windows." She lowered herself to her hands and knees. In the glare of the motorcycle headlights shining through the windows, she saw the silhouette of Oliver's gun. She fumbled with the catch of her handbag. Her fingers closed around the grip of the small pistol she kept inside. "I've got one too," she said. "Of course you do," Oliver said. He sounded resigned. "Ever fired it?"
"No. How hard could it be?"
"You'd be surprised."
"There are bullets in it," she said, offended by his tone.
"That helps."
She ignored the sarcasm. "Do you really think they mean to kill us?"
"Damned if I know," he said. "But whatever they came here to do, they intend to do it to you. They don't know I'm here, not yet, at any rate. That gives us an edge."
"Daisy Jennings?"
"She's dead in the water out back."
"Dear heaven, another drowning just as you predicted."
There was some shouting from outside. Two men, Irene realized. One man yelled at the other. "Do it! Hurry!"
"One of them is off his motorcycle," Oliver reported. "He's coming toward the warehouse. He's got something in his hand."
"Gun?"
"Yes, in one hand," Oliver said. "That's not what's worrying me. It's what he's got in the other hand that could be a very big problem. I just saw a flash of light. The bastard lit a fuse. Stay down."
A rapid staccato of gunshots roared in the night. Irene heard some of them thud into the wall behind her.
"Cover fire," Oliver said. His tone was devoid of all emotion.
"Cover for what?" Irene asked.
A fiery object sailed through one of the empty windows and landed on the floor. It exploded on impact. Flames leaped.
"Cover for a firebomb," Oliver said.
His gun roared once, twice.
"The bitch has a gun," one of the motorcyclists screamed. "No one said she was armed."
"Oliver,"
Irene said. He fired two more quick shots. There was another scream from outside the warehouse, an unmistakable howl of agony. One of the motorcycle engines roared furiously in the night.
"Dallas, I'm hit," a man yelled. "Wait for me."
The single motorcycle howled away on the dirt lane, the sound of the engine fading rapidly.
"One down," Oliver reported. "The other one is leaving. We have to get out of here. Rear door."
The hungry flames had begun to consume everything in their path. The heat was mounting, but Irene knew that the real danger was the smoke. She dropped her gun into her handbag, leaped to her feet, and ran for the wedge of moonlight that marked the freight door. She heard the heart-stopping thud behind her and knew instantly what had happened. She stopped and whirled around. In the blazing light, she saw Oliver sprawled on the floor.
"Oliver!"
"Go!"
The order was ice cold and infused with savage determination.
"Get the hell out of here!"
"I'm not leaving without you."
She rushed back to him and grabbed his arm.
"Damn it, Irene!"
She crouched and got her shoulder under his arm. Calling on every ounce of strength she possessed, she straightened. Somehow, between her desperation and the leverage he was able to apply with his undamaged leg, he was able to regain his feet. She grabbed his cane and handed it to him. Together, they made their way toward the freight door. Oliver's limp was worse than ever.
He was staggering now, forced to lean on her to keep himself upright. She knew he must have been in agony, but he did not say another word. Neither did she. There was no point. Either they both made it out of the inferno, or they didn't. They passed the crate where Jennings' handbag sat.
"Get it if you can,"
Oliver said, his voice harsh. She snagged the strap of the handbag with the same hand she was using to grip her own bag. Oliver regained some ability to keep his balance. He no longer needed so much support from her. They got through the loading dock doorway and kept going. Irene knew they had to get as far away as possible before the warehouse collapsed in flames. They made their way around to the front of the burning building and into the clearing. The fiery light revealed a man in a leather jacket crumpled on the ground. At first, Irene thought he was dead, but when they got closer, she heard him groan.
"Help me!"
he gasped. He levered himself into a sitting position and clutched his shoulder with one hand.
"You can't leave me here!"
"Sorry," Irene said. "You created the problem. You're stuck with it."
"Please," he gritted out. "Never meant to kill you, just scare you. Didn't know the place would go up like a torch. You gotta help me."
"Let's get him into the front seat of the car," Oliver said. Irene stared at him, astonished.
"Why? He just tried to murder both of us."
"No," the man yelped. "Didn't mean to kill anyone."
"We've got questions, and at the moment this bastard is the only one available with answers," Oliver said. "I'll keep an eye on him from the back seat."
"Bad idea," Irene said. "He has a gun."
"No gun," the man assured her. "Dropped it when you shot me. Name's Springer. I'll tell you anything you want to know. Just get me to a hospital, please."
"There's the gun," Oliver said. He steadied himself on his cane and pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket. "Use this to pick it up. The cops might be able to get some prints off of it."
Irene used the handkerchief to scoop up the gun. It was still warm. She wrapped it in the square of white linen.
"Got it," she said.
"Search him," Oliver said.
She found a knife strapped to Springer's leg.
"Forgot about the blade," Springer muttered.
"Sure you did," Irene said.
"I'll take that," Oliver said.
He grasped the knife in his free hand and looked down at Springer.
"Neither of us can get you on your feet. Can you make it to the car on your own?"
"I think so, yeah."
Springer managed to haul himself upright. Irene opened the passenger side door. Hand clamped to his shoulder, Springer crawled into the seat. Irene closed the door. Springer groaned and passed out. Oliver opened the rear door and climbed into the back of the Ford. He leaned forward and clamped a hand around Springer's wound. Irene got behind the wheel. She fired up the engine, put the car in gear, turned around in the clearing and started up the dirt road. Rocks spit under the tires.
"What are we going to do with Springer?" she asked.
"We'll take him to the Burning Cove Hospital. I'll call Detective Brandon and let him know what happened. If Springer makes it through the night, Brandon should be able to get some answers out of him."
"What about the fire?"
"We'll stop at the first place we see that might have a phone and notify the fire department. With luck, the clearing around the warehouse will keep the fire from jumping up the hillside. There's nothing but water at the back."
She reached the end of the lane and paused before turning onto Miramar Road. She glanced back at Oliver. He was pressing hard on Springer's wound. In the weak glow of the dashboard lights, his face was set in hard, grim lines.
"Are you all right?" she asked.
"Never better. Drive."
She pulled out onto Miramar Road and floored the accelerator.
"You know," she said, "in the movies, this sort of thing always looks a lot more thrilling."
"I've noticed that," Oliver said.
Chapter 27.
"I thought you didn't like guns," Irene said.
"I don't," Oliver said.
He drank some whiskey, lowered the glass, and rested his head against the back of the armchair.
But that doesn't mean they aren't occasionally useful.
Irene came to a halt in the middle of the living room and surveyed him with a critical eye. He knew the look all too well. He had been getting it every few minutes since they had walked through his front door a short time ago.
"Are you sure you're all right?" she asked.
Again. "I'm fine," he said, lying through his teeth.
He was heartily tired of the question, but he told himself she meant well. He tried to sort through his mixed reactions to her concern. Sure, it was nice that she cared, but he hated knowing that she had seen him at his weakest that night. He downed a healthy dose of whiskey to take his mind off the pain and his own miserable performance. He was sitting in one of the big leather chairs in front of the fireplace, his damned leg propped on a hassock. Shortly after Irene had brought him home, he ordered a large quantity of ice from room service. He now had 3 ice bags draped over his bad leg. Irene swallowed some of her own whiskey and resumed her pacing. "Nick Tremaine used poor Daisy Jennings to lure us to that warehouse tonight, and then he murdered her," she said.
"I agree, that's how it looks," Oliver said. He drank some more whiskey. "But it will probably be impossible to prove unless Springer wakes up and starts talking."
Irene shook her head. "I never meant to drag you into this situation."
"We've already had that conversation. I'd just as soon not reopen it, if you don't mind."
She stopped pacing and met his eyes. Whatever she saw there must have convinced her he meant every word. "All right," she said, uncharacteristically meek. She waved one hand in a vague gesture. "The problem now is, I don't know what to do next."
"Let's see what Detective Brandon does. The cops can't brush off Springer and his pal. Not now there's another dead woman."
"Another drowning victim who just happens to be one of Nick Tremaine's lovers," Irene said. Oliver paused the whiskey glass halfway to his mouth and watched her very deliberately, willing her to understand the significance of what had happened.
"Daisy Jennings is dead, but she was not the only target tonight," he said.
"I realize that." Irene put her glass down. "You and I were also targets."
"Not me," he said. "You. No one knew I was along for the ride. Not until it was all over."
She watched him, stricken. "I'm sorry."
He held up a hand. "Don't say it. What I'm getting at is that we now know for certain that someone is prepared to do whatever it takes to stop you. Springer said he and his pal were hired to scare you. That may be true. They may even believe it was the objective. But I think that whoever hired that pair to set fire to the warehouse would have been quite satisfied if you had died in the blaze."
Irene took a deep breath and went to stand at the window, looking out at the patio and the moonlit ocean. "My death in that warehouse would have made things simpler for him," she said.
"Yes. In addition, it would have provided a neat explanation for Jennings' death."
"The cops would have assumed that I killed her and then died when I accidentally knocked over a lantern and set fire to the warehouse. But what's my motive? Why would I murder Daisy Jennings?"
"I agree that the story is weak when it comes to motive, but I doubt if anyone would worry about that too much. The police would be happy to have it all tied up in a neat package."
Irene turned around. "Tonight was different because Tremaine used fire against me. Daisy and Gloria Maitland and the others were all made to look like cases of accidental drowning."
"There could have been any number of reasons for the change in his pattern. Magicians rework the same illusions in a variety of ways to keep the act convincing. The killer probably decided that 2 drowning victims at the same scene tonight would have been a little hard for the cops to ignore. Besides, fire has a number of advantages."
"Advantages?"
"It's a classic and highly effective way of destroying evidence."
Irene pondered that. I see what you mean.
The real question is, where did the killer find Springer and Dallas?
Springer implied that he and his pal were hired muscle, Irene said.
Tremaine is from out of town. He wouldn't know how to find local muscle.
So he brought Springer and Dallas in from L.A.?
Maybe,
Oliver said.
Or maybe the studio provided the pair to clean up the mess Tremaine made here in Burning Cove. There's no point speculating tonight. We need more information. We do know one thing, however.
Irene frowned. What?
It's obvious now that you're a target. You should not be alone. Not until we find out who tried to kill you tonight.
She gave him a sharp, unreadable look, and then turned her back to him. Her shoulders were very straight. I can't afford to hire a bodyguard, if that's what you're about to suggest, she said. And I'm sure my editor won't pay for one. Not for long, at least. How does one even go about hiring a bodyguard, anyway?
Forget the bodyguard. Finding one who knows his business and can be trusted isn't easy. You'll be better off staying here with me until this situation gets resolved.
She turned around.
Here? At the hotel, you mean? Here, in my private quarters. In spite of what happened to Gloria Maitland, I can promise you that I really do have good security, certainly better than the security at the Cove Inn. You'll be reasonably safe if you stay on the grounds of the hotel.
She stared at him, floored. It took her a moment to recover.
Thank you, she said. That's a very generous offer, but really, it's not necessary. My bedroom is down the hall, he said. He spoke very deliberately. On this floor, the guest suite is upstairs, if you will recall. You saw it the night you found Maitland's body in the spa.
He waited for his meaning to sink in. She flushed. I never meant to imply.
Trust me when I tell you that I avoid going up and down stairs whenever possible. You'll have plenty of privacy.
She turned red. I don't doubt for a moment that you would be a perfect gentleman. He wasn't sure that was a compliment, but he let it go.
Good, he said. It's settled then.
She got a stubborn look.
We both know I can't stay holed up here at the Burning Cove Hotel indefinitely. I've got a job that I can't afford to lose. I've also got an apartment in L.A. My editor told me that someone broke in while I've been out of town. What the hell? Your apartment was burglarized?
Evidently. I was planning to drive to the city today to get some fresh clothes and take a look around to see if the burglar stole anything. I'll have to go tomorrow instead. She glanced at the clock. Make that today.
Has it occurred to you that the break-in might be connected to your Nick Tremaine story?
Of course. Probably a studio job.
I can't help but notice that you don't seem overly concerned.
Naturally, I'm concerned, but it tells me I'm on the right track.
You're going to keep working on the Tremaine story? He grimaced. Of course you are. What was I thinking?
If I give up now, Nick Tremaine will continue to murder his lovers and get away with it. Tonight was a turning point. I can feel it. He's starting to panic.
We can't solve all of your problems tonight, but we can deal with one of them. Your safety. Spend the night here. I'll send someone to the inn to pick up your things. We'll get more information from the cops in the morning. That should help us decide what to do next.
She blinked. Us.
He swallowed the last of the whiskey and lowered the glass. Us, he said.
She fell silent, as if she could not think of a response.
He should probably take her lack of enthusiasm as a personal affront.
She started to resume her pacing, but stopped midway across the room. Daisy's handbag, she said. I forgot about it. I suppose we should give it to Detective Brandon.
They both looked at the green handbag sitting on the coffee table where Irene had dropped it earlier. Open it, Oliver said.
Irene went to the coffee table, picked up the bag and opened it.
She took out a lipstick, a compact, a hanky, a small coin purse, and a sheet of folded paper. She unfolded the paper. Looks like notes, handwritten. She read a few sentences aloud. Trust me, you'll want to hear what I've got to tell you. I know what really happened the night Gloria Maitland died. There's a phone booth on the corner of Olive and Palm Streets. Be there at 11:30 tonight. I'll call you and tell you where to meet me. There's an old abandoned warehouse at the end of Miramar Road. Remember, come alone. Deal's off if I see anyone else. Irene stopped and looked up, shocked. It's a script, she said. Someone gave Daisy Jennings a script to make sure she got all her lines right. Is that the end of the script? Irene looked down again. No, there's another line. It's scribbled in on the side of the page. A last-minute addition, maybe. Ask Tremaine about Island Knights and Pirate Captive. Those sound like film titles, Oliver said. But those aren't the two movies that Tremaine made in Hollywood. Tremaine wouldn't be the first fast-rising star to have a couple of pornographic movies in his past. That's the sort of problem that studios fix all the time, Irene said. You don't kill someone because of a pornographic film, she hesitated. Do you? That probably depends on what's on the film. Are we going to give this script to Detective Brandon? Irene asked. Not until we know for sure what's going on. Chapter 28. The assistant had given him the wrong key. It did not fit the lock that secured the chains. He was trapped in the steel cage. That was all the warning he got. He wasted precious seconds extracting the backup key from its hiding place and unlocking the chains that bound him. He knew then that he had not been given the wrong key by mistake. There were no mistakes in an Oliver Ward illusion. He was going to die if he did not free himself. The first shot ripped into his thigh. Blood poured out into a hot fountain. The second shot grazed the same leg. The third shot missed just barely. He heard the shriek of metal as the bullet struck the chains. He could hear the audience screaming now. The sound seemed to come from another dimension. He could not see anything because of the black curtains draped around the cage of death. The horrified shouts and screams got louder. He realized the blood was leaking out of the cage and falling onto the stage. His leg burned with cold fire. So did the truth. What had happened was not an accident. Oliver came awake in an icy sweat, the way he always did when the nightmare struck. He sat up slowly, wincing at the throbbing ache in his thigh. The combination of whiskey, aspirin, and ice had taken the edge off earlier, allowing him to fall into a restless sleep, but the effects had worn off. He thought about the medication that his doctor had given him for the really bad nights and decided against it. He hated the stuff. It dulled his mind and his senses for hours and put him into a peculiar twilight state. It was close to dawn. He had to be sharp in the morning. The killer was now targeting Irene. Plans had to be made. Action had to be taken. Energized by that reality, he grabbed his cane and stood up. He shoved his feet into slippers, pulled on a bathrobe, and let himself out into the hall. For a moment he stood in the shadows, listening intently. He was accustomed to solitude. At night, Casa del Mar echoed with silence. Tonight was different. All was quiet on the floor above, but he did not feel the deep sense of aloneness that he usually experienced in the hours between midnight and dawn. Irene was there. He walked across the moon-streaked living room, opened the French doors, and went out onto the patio. He stopped at the edge of his private pool.
The atmosphere was infused with the first faint light of dawn. The scents of the garden and the sea mingled in an invigorating tonic. Dawn was always the best antidote to the nightmare and the memories. He lowered himself onto the cushion of one of the fan-back rattan chairs and absently rubbed his leg while he contemplated options. He heard the soft sound of Irene's footsteps when she came down the stairs, walked through the living room, and emerged onto the patio. It occurred to him that he was not surprised that she had awakened. Her presence felt right. He could get used to this feeling of not being alone in Casa del Mar. Just an illusion, he thought.
Couldn't sleep? He asked.
I got some rest, she said, thanks to the whiskey.
The universal, if temporary, cure. Doesn't last forever, but while it does, it works fairly well.
Yes. She sat down in one of the other rattan chairs. In the early light, he could see that she once again wore one of the hotel's thick white spa robes. Her hair looked as if she had raked it back behind her ears with her fingers. He could sense the anxiety that was riding her, but he could also feel the gritty determination that was so much a part of her being.
"What secrets are you keeping, mystery woman?"
"I'll drive to L.A. with you today to pick up your things and check out the situation at your apartment," he said.
She gave him a quick, skittering, sidelong glance. He knew he had touched on the mystery beneath the surface.
"There's no need for you to make that long drive," she said. "I'm sure it would be uncomfortable for you, given your poor leg."
Irritation sparked through him. "It's my leg. Let me worry about it."
"If you're so convinced that I need a bodyguard, perhaps one of the people on your hotel security staff could go with me."
She wasn't objecting to the idea of having someone accompany her, but she was definitely uneasy with the prospect of having him as her companion. He realized that she didn't want him with her when she examined her apartment to see if anything had been stolen. She was afraid of what he might observe.
"I'll stay out of your way," he said.
She stiffened. "I didn't mean that I didn't want you along."
He smiled. "Sure you did."
"Look, you're welcome to drive to L.A. with me," she said. Her voice sharpened. "I was just concerned about your leg, that's all."
"I told you I'll take care of it."
"Fine, it's your leg."
"Yes, it's my leg."
She gave him a frosty look. "You're annoyed."
"Possibly."
"Are you always this irritable?"
"I don't know. You'll have to ask my staff."
She startled him with a steely smile. "No need to do that. I'm quite capable of forming my own opinion." He watched her warily.
"And just what is your opinion?"
"I think certain subjects, such as a mention of your leg, annoy you."
"It's a mention of my poor leg that annoys me."
"I'll try to remember that." She glanced around the patio as if searching for another topic of conversation. "I see you have your own pool."
"I use it for exercising my poor leg."
"Right." She rose, clamping the lapels of the robe with one hand. "I think I've irritated you enough for one day, and the sun isn't even up yet. I'd better go upstairs and see about getting dressed. We've got a long trip ahead of us." She turned and took two steps back toward the shadowed interior of the villa.
"Irene?"
She paused and looked at him over her shoulder. "Yes?"
"It's going to be all right. We'll figure this out together. Partners, remember?"
She walked back and came to a halt in front of him.
"Not just partners," she said. "Not after last night." "What then?"
"I don't know," she admitted. "I told you I knew that your friend Luther Pell trusted you. I found that reassuring. But after what happened last night, I know I can trust you. That means a lot, believe me."
"You know hardly anything about me."
"Everyone has secrets," she said. "It doesn't mean I can't trust you."
"That's good to know," he said, "because I trust you, too."
"Why?"
Hell, I don't know. Maybe because you refused to leave me alone in a burning building.
You wouldn't have left me there either.
So we know that much about each other. Is that enough?
It is for me, for now.
Then, before he realized what she intended, she bent down and brushed her lips lightly across his cheek. The heat of her body whispered to his senses. An unfamiliar certainty flashed through him. He started to reach for her, but she was already stepping back. He watched her disappear into the shadows of the living room. It was only after she was gone that he realized that for the past few minutes he had been entirely unaware of the pain in his leg. He smiled, bemused by his own reaction to the woman and the dawn of the new day. Magic.
Chapter 29. They were finishing a breakfast of fresh melon, creamy scrambled eggs, and toast on the patio when the phone rang. Oliver grabbed his cane and got to his feet.
With luck, that will be Brandon with an update, he said.
He disappeared into the living room to take the call. Irene slathered butter on a slice of toast and watched the sun dance on Oliver's private pool. She tried to ignore the nervy sensation that abruptly knotted her stomach. She reminded herself that she and Oliver had been expecting the call. The problem was that she had been savoring the intimacy of the moment. A perfect breakfast on the patio at the start of another perfect California morning. It was all a little too perfect. Reality had been bound to intrude. Oliver reappeared a few minutes later. His expression was severe, but she could sense the energy in the atmosphere around him.
Well, she said.
He lowered himself into the chair across from her. He seemed to be moving more easily this morning, she thought. She took that as a sign that he had not inflicted too much damage on his poor leg during the night. Scratch the paw, she thought. The man has his pride. She respected that.
Brandon says Springer and his pal, a guy who goes by the name of Dallas, are both hired muscle, Oliver said.
We guess that much. The question is, who hired them?
According to Springer, he and Dallas are both professional stuntmen. Seems work at the studios has been a little slow lately. So they've been picking up some extra cash by doing odd jobs for a shady character named McAllister, otherwise known as Hollywood Mac. Springer claims that he and his pal don't know who commissioned the arson last night. He says Hollywood Mac never tells them the name of the so-called client, but Brandon made some telephone calls to a pal in the L.A. Police Department. Evidently, Hollywood Mac is reputed to perform certain services for some of the studios, including the one that has Tremaine under contract.
In other words, Hollywood Mac rents out his tough guys to the fixers who are in charge of cleaning up the messes created by the studio's stars.
Cleaners, fixers, studio execs, whatever you call them, it's their job to make scandals disappear, Oliver said.
So, someone at Tremaine Studio hired those two stuntmen to get rid of me.
Brandon says Springer is sticking to his story. He was hired to torch the warehouse. He and his pal knew you would be there, but the idea was to scare you, not kill you.
But what about Daisy Jennings? How did Springer explain her body?
That's the really interesting part, Oliver said. Springer swears up and down that he didn't know there was a dead woman at the scene. Says all he and his pal were told was that a woman would be there and that they were to scare the hell out of her by setting fire to the place. You weren't supposed to die, Springer says. He insists they didn't know that old warehouse would go up like a torch. He expected you to come running out.
No, I'm sure that I was supposed to be dead or unconscious in that warehouse before Springer and Dallas arrived. The fire would have destroyed all the evidence at the scene. You were right. It would have looked like I accidentally died in a blaze that I started to cover up the murder of Daisy Jennings.
Yes, Oliver said evenly. I think that was the killer's plan.
But everything went wrong because you accompanied me to the warehouse.
Finish your coffee. My car should be ready by now. Chester checked it over this morning and topped off the gas tank.
A little thrill of excitement pulsed through her.
We're taking your car?
She asked, trying to make it sound casual.
Yeah. I don't trust that old sedan of yours. It's a long drive to L.A. and back, and most of it is open, empty country. Not a lot of gas stations on the way. We don't want to get stranded.
Right. A long trip. No need for you to do all the driving. I'll be happy to give you a break.
No.
Several hours of driving will be hard on your leg.
No.
It's a lovely day. We can put the top down.
Yes.
Do you ever let anyone drive your car?
No.
Chapter 30.
The offices of Hollywood Whispers were on the second floor of a small, nondescript building. Oliver looked around the grimy lobby, hoping to spot an elevator. There wasn't one. Irene paused at the foot of the stairs.
Why don't you wait here? I won't be long.
He managed to squelch the flare of temper, but it wasn't easy. She was just being thoughtful, he told himself. But damn it to hell, he was really tired of having his infirmity pointed out. The last thing he wanted from Irene was sympathy.
I'll come with you, he said.
He was careful to keep his tone neutral, but she blinked and looked a little taken aback. He realized she must have seen something in his eyes, warning her that she was getting too close to the invisible line he had drawn.
Suit yourself, she said.
She took the stairs like a gazelle, getting too close to the invisible line he had drawn.
Suit yourself, she said.
She took the stairs like a gazelle. He watched her curvy rear disappear down a hallway. While the view was gratifying, he knew he probably deserved to get left behind in her dust. He was too touchy about the damned leg. He tightened his grip on his cane, grasped the handrail, and started up the stairs. At the top, the relentless clacking of typewriter keys emanated from a large room crowded with desks and reporters. Several office doors stood open, but the one labeled editor was closed. He raised his hand to knock, but the door was yanked open before he could do so. Irene glared at him. Her cheeks were flushed and her eyes were hot with temper.
"We're leaving," she announced. "I've been fired."
Behind her, a large, middle-aged woman with improbably red hair sat behind a battered desk. Velma Lancaster, he decided. Although she was sitting very still, she seemed to vibrate with nervy energy. She studied Oliver through a pair of spectacles perched on her sharp nose.
"So, you're the amazing Oliver Ward," she said.
"And you're Irene's ex-boss."
"It's a little more complicated than that," Velma said. "Why don't you both sit down and we'll discuss this like civilized people?"
She had a voice that would have projected quite well from a stage. Irene rounded on her.
"I'm not feeling very civilized today. Last night I almost got burned alive, and now you tell me I'm out of a job."
Velma waved that off with an impatient gesture.
"Sit down," she snapped.
To Oliver's surprise, Irene sank reluctantly into a wooden chair. She clutched her precious handbag on her lap and fixed Velma with a wary, narrow-eyed gaze. Velma turned her attention back to Oliver.
"What's your relationship to Irene, Mr. Ward?"
"We're partners," Irene said. "He was with me last night when we found another body, and two goons tried to torch a warehouse with us inside." Velma did not take her eyes off Oliver.
"Well, Ward, what do you have to say for yourself?"
"You heard her," Oliver said. "We're partners."
He walked into the room, closed the door, and sat down.
"Are you going to explain why the situation here is more complicated than it appears?"
"Yes, that's exactly what I'm going to do."
Velma leaned back. Her chair squeaked in protest.
"Can you protect Irene?" "My security people are good," he said, "and Luther Pell is a friend of mine. He has offered his assistance if needed."
Irene's head snapped around, her eyes widened. "You didn't tell me that," she said.
He waved that off. "There wasn't any reason to until now. I thought it might make you uneasy."
Velma got a knowing look.
"That would be the same Luther Pell who owns the Paradise Club and some casinos?"
"Yes," Oliver said. "That Luther Pell."
"In other words, you've got access to some serious muscle."
"Yes," Oliver said again.
Irene looked at Velma and then at Oliver and back again.
"Where are you going with this conversation, Velma?"
"Here's the deal," Velma said. She sat forward and lowered her voice. "This morning I got another call from Ernie Ogden at Tremaine's studio. I was given a second warning. This time things got a lot more serious. It was strongly implied that Whispers would be out of business within a week if I didn't get rid of the reporter who was causing trouble for Tremaine. So naturally I assured Mr. Ogden that I would fire Irene Glasson, and that's what I've done. I even instructed Alice in bookkeeping to cut one last check with a week's extra pay. It's waiting for you at the reception desk."
Irene groaned. "I'm sorry, Velma. I didn't mean to put Whispers at risk. I thought I could prove Tremaine murdered Peggy, and it would be a huge scoop for the paper."
"I agreed to let you run with the story because of Peggy. I do not take kindly to having my employees murdered, but I am now in the position of having to protect the rest of the staff and this business."
"I understand," Irene said. She got to her feet. "Let's go, Oliver."
"Hang on for one damn minute," Velma said.
"Why?" Irene asked.
"This doesn't have to be the end of the line. You can work for freelance. If you do get proof that Tremaine murdered Peggy or anyone else, and if Tremaine is arrested, I'll buy the story from you."
"I'll think about it," Irene said, "but keep in mind that I might get a better offer from some other paper."
She headed for the door. Oliver followed her out into the hall. "What are you going to do?" he asked.
"Get the story."
He nodded, satisfied. "I had a feeling you were going to say that."
The receptionist looked up as they approached her desk. She gave Irene a sympathetic smile and handed her an envelope.
"Sorry about what just happened," she said softly.
"Thanks," Irene said.
"Did your cousin get a hold of you?"
Irene stopped, turning sharply.
"What cousin?"
"A man telephoned for you yesterday. Sounded like he was from back east. Real classy accent. Said he was your cousin or something, and that he was in town on business for a few days. He wanted to see about getting together with you. I gave him your address and phone number. Warned him that you were out of town, though."
"Thanks," Irene said. She looked at Oliver. There was shock and confusion in her eyes.
"The studio? Trying to find out where I live?"
"Probably," he said. "Let's go."
Chapter 31. The first clue that she had other problems in addition to getting fired came when she inserted her key into the lock on her apartment door. Nothing happened.
"Wrong key?" Oliver suggested.
Irene looked at the key she was holding.
"No, this is the right one."
They were standing in the hall outside her apartment. She was very conscious of the general gloom that seemed to infuse the slightly shabby two-story building. The contrast between it and the warm, gracious architecture of the Burning Cove Hotel was impossible to ignore. Oliver studied the lock.
"Looks new."
"Of course, that explains it," Irene said. Relief flashed through her. "The burglar must have broken the lock when he forced his way into my apartment. Mrs. Drysdale, my landlady, replaced it. I'll go downstairs and let her know I'm back and that I need the new key."
"I'll come with you," Oliver said.
She had started down the hall, but at that she stopped and turned around.
"No need for you to go down those stairs twice."
"I'll come with you,"
he said again. Just in case.
In case of what?
We're wasting time, Irene.
Right. She was very conscious of Oliver making his way down the stairs behind her. His cane thudded on each step. She heard the hitch in his stride. He never said a word, but she knew that the descent must have been painful for him, considering what he had gone through in recent days. When she reached the first floor, she went along another dingy hallway and knocked on Norma Drysdale's door.
"Hold your horses!"
Norma yelled in the harsh, hoarse voice of a lifelong smoker.
"I'm coming!"
The door swung open. Norma appeared, wearing a faded house dress and an invisible cloak of stale smoke. Her bleached hair was set in tight Marcel waves, a style that had been the height of fashion until recently, but that now, thanks to stars like Ginger Rogers and Katharine Hepburn, had a decidedly dated look. Norma peered at Irene as though trying to recall her name.
"Oh, it's you," she rasped. "Wondered when you'd show up. I was getting ready to sell your things. Figured I'd give you a week to collect them."
"What?" It took Irene a couple of seconds to gather her wits. "But I'm current on my rent." Norma's expression softened fractionally.
"Sorry, but you're trouble, honey, and I don't need any more of that particular commodity. Got plenty as it is."
Norma paused to indulge a coughing fit. "What are you talking about?" Irene asked. "I've been a model tenant. I pay my rent on time. I don't bring men back to my apartment. I don't make a lot of noise." Norma got a sorrowful expression.
"Things change, honey. Like I said, sorry, but that's how it is."
Oliver studied Norma.
"I assume you've had a visit or a phone call from someone who advised you that it was in your best interest to evict Miss Glasson."
"Yeah. The studio sent a goon around."
Norma squinted at him.
"Probably the same one that broke into 2B a couple of times."
"He broke in twice," Oliver said.
"Yeah."
"Why would he do that?" Irene asked.
"How should I know?"
Norma shrugged.
"First time he made a mess. It looked like the real deal, a straight-up burglary. So I called the cops, and then I called you to let you know what had happened. But after the second break-in last night, I figured the bastards were trying to send a message."
"What message?" Oliver asked.
"Just trying to scare Irene, I guess. Let her know she wasn't safe anywhere. That they could get to her."
Norma broke off to cough a few more times. When she had composed herself, she eyed him more closely.
"You're the amazing Oliver Ward, aren't you? The magician who bungled his last act and nearly got himself killed? There was a picture of you and Irene in Silver Screen Secrets yesterday morning."
He ignored that. "What was the threat that convinced you to toss Miss Glasson out into the street?"
Norma shrugged.
"I was told that if I didn't get rid of a certain troublesome tenant, there would be an accidental fire. Might lose the whole apartment house. This building is my retirement. Can't afford to risk it."
Irene pulled herself together and took a step back. "I'm sorry I got you involved, Mrs. Drysdale. Where are my things? I'll get them and leave you in peace."
"I put your stuff in some boxes," Norma mumbled.
She did not make eye contact.
"Broom closet at the end of the hall."
"I'll get them," Irene said. She started to turn away. Norma grunted.
"Here's a tip, honey. The studios own this town. You don't cross them. Not if you want to make a living. The sooner you figure that out, the better off you'll be."
Irene paused. "I'm getting the message." Norma switched her attention back to Oliver.
"Saw your act once. You were darn good. At least back before you messed up. I liked the way you made that pretty woman in the skimpy dress walk straight into the mirror and disappear. What went wrong that day you were almost killed?"
"I can't tell you," Oliver said. "Magician's code."
"Huh?"
Oliver looked at Irene.
"Let's get your things."
Irene turned on her heel and started down the hall.
She heard the door slam shut behind her. There was a very final-sounding snick as the bolt slid home. An odd sensation ghosted through her, a mix of wistfulness and resignation.